This is The Conversation. It's episode 181 with Kaisa Johnson, part one. She is a Los Angeles-based artist and activist, and I am thrilled to be putting this episode out to you. We know each other, I should say, and this is how it started. I saw a number of social media posts from her in action, in activism, at protest marches and whatnot at LAX airport. And it occurred to me, I can't be sleeping on this, the mood that's going on. I know I have referred to it very sort of subtly in the past, but I thought it was a great opportunity to talk with somebody who is an artist who is confronting this new climate head on. And it turned out to be a good choice, as I think you will hear. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the podcast is theconversationpod.com, where I highly recommend you go see Kaisa in action, protesting her work, which includes the Terrible Emperor series. So very appropriate and fitting. That's all at the website. Go check it out. I'm on my cheap microphone. That's why I sound a little different. Almost forgot to put this part in. And so, yeah, it wound up being two parts. This first part is going to cover the activism, the politics. We do talk about politics, just to give you a trigger warning. I think you will find it heartening, though. At least I hope you're on that side that will find it heartening. And if you aren't, I'd be interested to hear from you. So stay tuned for that. And yeah, I can't think of a better guest to have this conversation with. And, you know, you will hear that. Before we get there, I wanted to tell you a couple of things. One is that there is a companion article that I found just after we recorded, actually. It was probably out about that same time. And it would have been interesting to have read as we talk about some of the more detailed elements of being active right now. It's an article in New Yorker called Call and Response from March 6 by Catherine Schultz, who has proven herself to be a rather provocative writer for the magazine regularly in the past. I'll read you an excerpt from that on the back end, just in case you don't get to it, to give you a flavor of it. And before we get to the conversation with Kaisa, I just wanted to give a big thank you to the new batch of supporters that have come around to the conversation recently. I want to thank you guys so much. It's about three or four people via PayPal and another three on Patreon. And just to remind you, Patreon is a really easy way to support the show, and in that you can support the show for as little as a dollar a month. So it can be something that you don't notice, essentially, in your bank account. I mean, a dollar a month, that's not going to be too bad. Of course, if you start at three or more, you will be eligible for rewards and be more on the fast track. There is somebody who gave is giving $20 a month or pledging that much. So I don't expect that, but you know, if you can get up there a little bit, it would certainly make a big difference. And it's been heartening again to receive all the support in the last week or so. It really encourages me to keep it to once a week as opposed to what I talked about, moving it back to once every other week. So I think we're going to be able to keep it once a week, but I'm afraid that it's going to be a once a week fundraising thing for the time being. So just keep that in mind. Thank you very much for being here. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with part one with Kaisa Johnson. I will talk to you more, and I'll read some of that call and response article on the back end. Thank you for being here. That would have been that's a perfect beginning, actually, because I was just saving the test, but you say that again.
Oh, no, I don't remember what I said. I've just been so amped or on edge, and like I have deadlines and I'm doing eight different things at once, that the minute I decide to take time for myself and relax, I'm totally gonna get sick. Or if I go home. Is that working?
That's better. Yeah.
Okay.
If you go home being,
well, just if anything happens that allows me to let down my guard and my like energy level, then I will get sick. It just happens every time.
When do you let down your guard?
If I go home to visit my mom, or if we go to see my dad in Mexico, or go see somewhere where you're not surrounded by the pressures of your daily life, then, you know, it's like you open yourself up to getting sick.
So is that, see the subtext of everything you're talking about is that on a daily basis in your life here, you have a, you're on guard all the time.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I'm constantly like, you know, there's a very in regimented structure to my life and my day, and that I'm always thinking about something or thinking, you know, or doing something or thinking about doing something or having to go get somebody to pick them up. And so when all of those constraints fall away and you kind of relax for a second, that's when you're kind of
right.
Immune system is like, you know, you're relaxed. You're vulnerable, I guess.
Yeah. You know? You're vulnerable. Right.
I mean, that's what my husband always say. Like whenever we go to one of our parents' houses, like one of us gets sick because you can.
Yeah.
You can get sick. Someone will take care of you.
Right. You know? Oh, I see. That's a really interesting way of putting it. Yeah.
You're like,
you know, you mentioned your dad, and that's a pretty crazy story. And
it'd be
interesting to see if we get to it more organically than just my bringing up now. But obviously, the main reason I should say that we're talking is that you're. Life, I don't know. I'm maybe overstating the introduction or preface.
All right,
here.
I'm excited
but
to hear
yeah,
it.
Yeah. I want to say that your life has taken a big, if not a literal change, a big moral change. And so, and I was thinking about it. Now, the question I first wanted to ask you is, if everything changed in November of 2016, or if there was something even before then that was kind of going on as well.
I think that's an I guess I've been thinking about that too. And I think that there's always been something. I've always resisted extreme structures, I guess. Like, I don't know if, and it was interesting because I was listening to the conversation that you had with, and I'm forgetting his name because I'm bad with names.
Nato Thompson?
No, well, that too. No, the Mormon. Because
remember. Oh, Casey Smith.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you that I was ex-Mormon?
Yeah, but you mentioned it, but was it because your mom, or you were when you were a kid?
Oh, I was very like in a very active Mormon
family. Okay, talk about that.
So this leads up to your question,
right,
I guess,
right. Okay.
Is that, I mean, my parents were divorced when I was very young and my dad was always a Jack Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't kind of that strong structure there. But my mom's family was and is still very Mormon, and she was, and we went to church every Sunday, blah, blah, blah. At a certain point, they divide you into boys and girls. I think you're 11. And they start teaching the men that they get the priesthood, which means you have a direct relationship with God. Women don't get a direct relationship with God. So
I see where this is going.
Yes. This is why it all ties in.
Right.
So you're in this class, you're 11 years old or 12 years old maybe. And they're basically teaching you how to be a good wife because you have to get married. Because the only way you can have contact with God is through your father or your husband. And that the husband is like the boss of you, essentially. He also has the power to let you into heaven or not. So...
God, this is like a preview of your nightmare.
Yeah. Right? So this, you know, I have always been a questioning person and a kind of contrary person. And if you tell me no, that's like the best way to get me to like motivate me to do something. It's like, you can't do it. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll show you I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that coupled with the fact that my parents were divorced, so I was always already kind of a black sheep in the community. I fought a lot with my teachers and I would get into these crazy arguments in class and I was like referred to the bishop and they, you know, was reprimanded. They assigned me this girl, Carrie Grahams, to like befriend me. Cause she was like the perfect girl and she was supposed to like bring me back into the fold, which like I totally knew what was going on. That I was not going to fall for that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So I, at some point, I was having a huge fight with one of my teachers. It was this class where they were, it was one of the classes where you were being told that your husband will be your boss, essentially. And I, you know, questioned that. And they were like, well, you have some say, you know, on things like where you go for vacation or like what clothes to buy the kid. Like, you know, you have some negligible power within the relationship. Mm-hmm. And I got so upset and I was bawling. And the teacher told me that I had no respect for my Heavenly Father and that I was being told to question by, you know, Satan, essentially. And I like ran out of the classroom bawling, looking for my mother, who unbeknownst to me was also having like questioning being in the church. And was going to sacrament meeting, which is the first part of church, which is like the whole family, and then leaving when everyone's separated into groups and going to the gym. And then putting her church clothes back on and coming back, you know, to pick us up as if she'd been there the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to find her. I couldn't find her. I like went and sat outside. I'm like crying. Like, I'm never going to go back to this terrible place. This is crazy. These people are crazy. None of this makes sense. And my mom comes like speeding into the parking lot, like, you know, from the gym, comes running in, is like, what are you doing outside? And I explained. And at that point, she was like, well, do you not want to go back? And I was like, no, I don't want to go back. And she was like, all right, well, then I'm not going to go back. And then my brother, who was 8, she was like, do you want to go back? And he didn't care. He was like, oh, I want to go. So we stopped going. My lead up to this is, I guess, that when I'm put into a circumstance that is so extreme that there's the only option to get out of it is to fight back extremely, kind mm-hmm. of equally and oppositely, that is my instinct. Like, I have that, like, kicking instinct. So, to come back, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, like, I've... The financial crisis, I was totally fascinated by that. I did a few pieces of work and installations that directly related to that, but I didn't, you know, go so far as to, you know, become an Occupy Wall Street protester, you know, any of those things. So I guess the extremity of the situation wasn't so great that it pushed right. me, you know, kind of my reaction was equal to, I guess, to my experience of it, which was like, I'm going to make these big pieces of work about it and think about it and discuss it and show it to the world, but I'm not going to march and I'm not going to, you know, go yell about it and call people about it, you know. So November.
By the way, yeah. Do you feel, I can't help but wonder if you feel more like you're more in the head of an Occupy Wall Streeter now that you've been through what you have? Because because at the time, you know, it wasn't quite enough for you to, you know,
yes.
like they felt like yeah. this sort of extreme front line. But yeah. now in retrospect, maybe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it just like broke the seal.
Right.
It was, I think it's also like having kids now that like I mm-hmm. feel the weight of it more.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only my world, it's like my children's world.
Yeah.
And you kind of know that, of course, we're passing it along to other people. But when it's like that direct protective instinct too, it's like, you know, the purpose becomes greater also, I
yeah.
guess.
And before you continue with sort of describing what your reaction to the election was, because
yeah.
I think that's where we're heading. Just can we just do a quick review?
Because
I'm not fully up to speed, but I know that you went to the March on Washington
yeah.
and then you also went to the march in New York, right?
Oh,
or you were in New York.
I was in New York afterwards.
Oh, okay. Got
no,
it.
I went to the first march here, like right after the week after the election or whatever it was. That was kind of the spontaneous gathering
right
like I guess Pershing Square
or, right
yeah mm-hmm. I don't know all the geography here yet. And then I went to the March on Washington, and then I went to New York because it was cheaper actually to fly back from New York than it was to fly back from Baltimore or Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I was marching with some friends from New York. It just made more sense to do that,
right?
So I was in New York, and then I've been trying to like divide up my activism, I guess, into like, okay, I'll march every month and a half, and I will go to meetings once a week, and I will, you know, call every other day, and sort of structuring it like that.
And you were at the airport.
Oh, and I went to the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a spontaneous, like, I didn't go to the one on the weekend because I'd literally just gotten back from the Women's March.
Right.
And I really wanted to go.
Mm.
And I was feeling really bad that I wasn't there. But I hadn't had like a day with my family,
right,
you know, in a week.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that led to that next, it was the Tuesday after, I guess. I knew there were marches, you know, people were still going to the airport because it was still going on. I was like, I've got to go do something. And one of the groups that I had been going to posted that they needed food and like phone chargers and things like that for the people who were being detained.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend and I just went and bought a bunch of sandwiches and like phone chargers and brought stuff to the airport. And we were looking for people to protest with and didn't like see anyone initially. And then we saw this one girl like walking through the airport with a sign and we're like, follow her. And so we followed her and like found someone else who was sitting with the sign. And then someone else came and found us and we became this little crew.
Mm-hmm.
There ended up being a larger protest later in the day, but we were kind of the like, you know, holding the spot, I guess, for a while.
Right.
With our signs.
So what has it been like? I mean, that is obviously a very different dynamic from being at these huge, you know, gatherings.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess what has it been like just being, what do you call it? Do you call it being an activist, being a protester?
I guess all of those things.
Okay. Being active?
Being
nothing
active.
Else?
Yeah, I think yeah. It's like being active.
Right.
It's like a necessary thing to do. Like, what else do you do? I mean, we're watching something go down that could potentially destroy our entire system
right.
of
right.
democratic government.
Like, absolutely. And is.
But, and is. Exactly.
But,
yeah.
But without getting too much into politics. But to play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure you've read about this,
yeah.
You know, in the wake of the LA march, for example, mm-hmm. which is, I guess, the biggest ultimately
yeah,
in terms of
I
numbers,
know.
Right?
That,
yeah.
I've heard differing reports on that.
Yeah.
But it's certainly like comparable, if not bigger. Yeah.
But regardless,
yeah,
the LA,
you don't want to be all Trumpy.
Right. Exactly. All of the marches though,
mm-hmm.
what some people, you know, sort of with a critical eye who are on the right side,
yeah.
if you will,
yeah.
were saying is, you know, I'm not sure ultimately what this is doing. I mean, it's a feel good kind of thing. It's
right.
it's a great experience for people. I didn't
totally
do it myself, but that's what everybody has said, right?
Oh yeah. I mean,
yeah.
it's an amazing experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I mean, the question is, I mean, one obvious practical question is, okay, so for all say 700,000 people who are at the LA
mm-hmm.
March, what is their calendar look like the next
right.
day?
Yeah. Well.
And you are an exception, and that's why we're talking.
Right. Because I'm like especially
yeah.
angry, especially kicky.
Yeah.
Okay. A few things to that point.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did like right after the election was like, asked for a list from people of like movies that deal with protest, with like, you know, revolt, with resisting, with civil movements that worked or didn't work. And so I haven't gone through them all, but like, you know, watching Spartacus and Selma and Gandhi and there's an Italian one I can't remember the name of. And looking at history and the history of civil movements, there's several things that have to happen and they all kind of need each other.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things is the visibility of protest. So
right.
you're telling your representatives in the government that you like are pissed and you don't agree and you're showing it. You're showing other citizens that, you know, this many people don't agree and it's kind of safe to join you, that you're not alone if you feel that way. It encourages other people who might be like, I don't know, do I say something? Nobody else is saying something. Like,
right.
to say something and do something.
Mm-hmm.
Shows the rest of the world that you don't agree with what's happening, which I think is important. I mean, and to back that up, look at all of the protests that happened around the world. I mean, Antarctica, they showed up in Antarctica, like, you know, 10 people or whatever, like that it's a show of solidarity. And I think for people to do other things like calling their representatives or writing letters or postcards or volunteering, that knowing that there's the weight of crowds behind you helps you to do those actions, even if you might be like nerve, like I hate calling my representatives, but like I do it, and then I'm so glad when it's done.
What for people who haven't yet done that, what is that experience like?
Well,
you get an aide, right?
Well, some of them, well, now I know like who has message boxes and who has an aide, and
right,
whatever.
Right.
Adam Schiff, you always get a person and they're always super nice. But then I get self-conscious that I've like called like 3 times a week and like sometimes the guy recognized the guy's voice and I like know he's like, it's that lady from Los Angeles calling again.
Right, right.
The crazy lady from Waverly Drive. Then Kamala Harris, you can leave a message. Dianne Feinstein, am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. You can never get through. You can fax her. Sometimes I've called in at night and I've gotten through after they've like emptied the mailbox.
So does that mean then that there are so many people contacting her that you can't get? So that's good.
So that's great.
Yeah.
It's a good sign.
Yeah.
Totally.
Right.
But I just get like, I don't like speaking. I get stage fright, essentially. Like, I don't even like calling, like, the credit card company. You know, I don't know. It's stupid.
Do you have a script?
Yeah. So I always write out a script beforehand, mm-hmm. which I may have gotten from Facebook or, like, made up myself or, mm-hmm. you know, some app that I'm using that's telling me who to call for what purpose. Yeah, so the script helps. You know, and really you only have to, like, do that. Hi, my name is so-and-so. I'm a constituent. Here's my address.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to, you know, support this action by so-and-so, and done. And they say, thank you, we'll pass along your message.
This is the approach that I have been envisioning having with any of these people. Something more along the lines of, what is Kamala Harris doing about what's going on right now, et cetera, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you can have that
conversation. Do you do that at
all? No, because, again, I get nervous.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, and I'm going to forget what I want
right.
to talk about.
Right.
And I mean, I think if, again, I like scripted it out really well, then I could go in.
Right.
I mean, before I give an artist talk or whatever, I literally spend the day before freaking out, not eating, and like memorizing like my own process, which is absurd. Like,
so you have stage fright.
I have stage fright, yes, is the point. So that I even get stage fright with, like, you know, calling these people.
Got it.
I had another point about
It'll come
protesting.
Back to you.
Maybe I covered both points. Oh, and that in every social movement, one of the things that works and that you need as an arm of resistance for civil resistance to work is boots on the ground, people protesting, people showing up over long periods of time. To show everyone that you are not going away, that it is still happening, you are still mad, you are still engaged. Like, that is one arm that needs to happen.
Right, right.
As
a fairly recent transplant from New York, it's been, a year and...
2 years in July.
Oh, 2 years. Okay, it's a year and a half.
Yeah,
three and three quarters.
Yeah.
Do you feel, is part of your thinking during this whole process reaching out to some of your friends still in New York and going, are you protesting outside Trump Tower right now? Because if you're not, you should be.
Yeah. I mean, I sometimes feel bad because so many of the people I know in New York are literally at a protest like every week. I mean, they are active.
Right.
And like some people are showing up at Trump Tower, with just like one guy with a sign, you know, or like, and then, you know, bigger ones at Washington Square Park and outside of the Trump Hotel. And like New York is showing up. So I'm glad they help spur me on, you know. It does kind of become this like, oh, so-and-so's doing this. Well,
right.
Hey.
Right.
In a good way. Like,
right.
You know, like healthy protest competition, I guess. You know, and you also see like waves of people being active. So like someone will be super active for a few weeks and then like step back for a minute and then you'll see them back at it again. And like it's kind of good also to see the baton being passed between people, that there is kind of a steady presence, but it's not necessarily like it might be the steady presence intermittently of 10 people. Just that there's like that it's helpful to see people in New York doing things, you know, that I kind of feel good that there's like my crew or like the people that I know are like spread out and I'm seeing it happening in like both places.
Yeah, that's great.
So
that's great. Yeah. So my understanding is that after the election, you know, and all of us lost hope that there was going to be a, you know, a change in the electoral college system and so on. That was like the last straw. Was the beginning for you the Women's March, you know, as far as your, you know, beginning momentum, or did it start before that?
No, it started before that. I mean, I guess it started like right afterwards. Like, I tend to feel better with concrete things and concrete actions.
Mm-hmm.
And research.
Mm-hmm.
Like I guess like a large part of my work is research based. And so that kind of translated immediately, like for a few weeks, like what I'd been doing in the studio seemed like ridiculous and pointless and
mm-hmm.
inconsequential in the face of everything. And so whatever energy I had that it had been going there all of a sudden pivoted and went to like, what the fuck do we do? Like, what do I do? What do I do today that can somehow
mm-hmm.
help? And so
what was the first step?
I'm trying to like think. I mean, I certainly, well, first I donated to like foster, well, started signing every petition that came up, you know,
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
whether or not now they're saying that's like not the most effective way to do things. I mean, especially now that the White House is paying no attention to like anything like that. But it was a start, I guess. It was like something to do. It got you in the mode of the practice. Oh, I'm going to say it, but in a different context. The practice of doing something every day. Like just the routine that you're like, okay, I'm going to sign something today. I'm going to call someone today. I'm going to donate to a campaign. Oh, first, oh my God, I donated like as much money as I possibly could to every single cause. Like, if you needed money, you should have asked me, like, November, December.
Literally. Well, ACLU was that number one?
Planned ACLU, Parenthood. Planned Parenthood, Heritage Foundation. Am I saying, not Heritage?
No. That's the concern.
Oh, my God, not Heritage. What the heck? What's the, it's like a
Does it start
gay
with an H, too?
Maybe.
I'm not sure.
Wait, take that out.
It was
it's the one that it's like the biggest donator to like LGBTQ rights.
Okay. I'm not sure which one that
Shoot.
Is.
Yeah. Anyway, I can look
we'll
it
look
up.
We'll look it up.
Find
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Sierra Club.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Foster Wallace, who was like the one possibility to like turn one more seat into a Democratic seat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually was interviewed by the Times-Picayune for that. Because they were like, why are all of these out-of-state people all of a sudden like sending money to Louisiana to this like weird small race?
Did that work or did that not
work?
Didn't work.
So really like within that first week, I was just like giving money away, signing petitions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Started, you know, watching all these movies about resistance and protest and like.
What was the strongest of those, do you think?
Oh, Selma's so good. I think Selma and Gandhi. I mean, of course, Gandhi's like one of the best movies ever, I think. Selma, I think, was particularly good because it illustrated the tactics, the really conscious tactics of civil resistance. And the you know, within one seemingly cohesive group, like the dissension. And like, no, we should be doing this. And no, we should be doing this. And kind of the push and pull within a group, which I think, you know, we're all seeing happen. We saw before the election and we also are seeing now, you know, where people are like debate like, oh, no, we should be doing this or this or this person. You know, still this like Hillary Bernie thing, I think this, you know, how far like you're not progressive enough or you're like too mainstream or, you know, but seeing, I guess, the importance of those discussions, but kind of the importance to the outside world that, like, you're not having those discussions, that you're kind of a united front. And then also picking the bad guy, that, like, you need to be perceived by the press and by the world as the people standing up in the right way, peacefully, against a terrible other. And that you kind of need that terrible other to show what you are. And, you know, they're picking Selma because they know that the sheriff, or the, let's say, like, the state marshal, or mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly, is, like, a racist bastard, and he's violent, and he's not going to stand for them being there, and he's going to push back in a really ugly way. Whereas they had been in another town where the guy was more strategic and smarter and just kind of let them do their thing, and there was nothing to report. There was nothing to resist against, essentially. Right, I mean, right. It was there underneath in the system, but not outwardly displayed by a villain, you know, that the press could latch onto to show the world, like, this is what's happening. So that was super interesting. Yeah, I just think that, like, understanding that you need to be smart and organized, and to understand, like, that it's a tactical game. I mean, Gandhi understood that too. And that peaceful resistance is the only sustainable way to go. And, like, studies have shown that you cannot, if you want to succeed as a resistance to something, any destruction or violence is only going to hurt your cause.
Right.
You know, I feel like that's obvious, but maybe not to everyone. But that is very well illustrated in both Selma and Gandhi.
So yeah. Where were we before?
I think we're talking about, like, the best protests.
I should
give you the list, because it was a good Newsies was on there. That was interesting.
Well, here's what I wanted.
Trumbo. Oh, Trumbo's really good too. That's really good, I think, especially for, like, artists to watch.
Why?
Because he, you know, it's showing the power of resisting as an artist. I guess resisting in a cultural way.
Right.
Is, like, important. And it may, like, seem to fail short term, but actually long term it has a big impact.
So the thing that I was thinking about as you were talking about the movies and the stuff around that is at a certain point you started making portraits of dictators.
Emperors.
Terrible emperors. Got
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. I've interested in history in general. It's very, like, how can you not be? Specifically Roman history. And I guess it was a very direct 4 years ago, actually this week, I had done a series and a large installation, a solo show, and then a solo armory booth that happened at the same time. And the series was called Empire Loop, and it was looking at Piranesi's etchings of Roman ruins, and then also sort of images from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's just like, empires can only last a certain amount of time. Like, there's just an ebb and flow of power structures that's kind of inbuilt into history. So with an eye to that, like, America is kind of entering that phase where, like, pretty soon being, like, you know, how, you know, maybe 100 years, maybe 200 years, like, we're definitely declining. How fast that will happen is, you know, contingent on what happens, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it's inevitable. It's just the way it is. Fine. Like, we should accept that. We know that. Like, let's understand these things from history and, like, know how to mediate them in the best way that we can. And then the booth was a recreation of the Bank of America's corporate office waiting room. So this was looking at, like, the show was looking at, like, America as an empire and in decline, and Rome, and using subatomic decay patterns, which is a mark that I often use to denote, like, collapse or transformation or change, or, like, change over time. So it was the Bank of America's corporate office waiting room. and then everything was painted over with chalkboard paint and then drawn in a kind of trompe-l'oeil way. It was this amalgamation of Piranesi's Roman ruins that became kind of, you know, you could see that it was three-dimensional, but when you looked from the center, you were looking into, like, the ruins of Rome. Mm-hmm. And a big Bank of America sign in the back. And it was looking at collapse at, like, all of these different levels. You have the physical collapse of the, you know, subatomic decay patterns, the physical collapse of the material of the buildings that represent, you know, Rome and its greatness fallen, the collapse of an empire, the collapse of, like, a system, kind of like the turning point of the collapse of an unsustainable system that is, you know, corrupt.
And why was it Bank of America?
Bank of America specifically. I mean, they were, you know, a big part of the financial collapse of 2008. But because it was America, you know, it was the Bank of America. So you're not just talking about the actual Bank of America, which, you know, was relevant, but also kind of like the cultural, like America, like the holdings of America, the like well of America, that it was like, you know, also on the precipice, that all of these things were kind of tumbling.
Mm-hmm.
So Rome is has always been something of a go-to in my mind for, you know, history, for looking at, you know, America as a power. Also, the only response I can have artistically right after the election was to draw terrible Roman emperors. And researching these terrible Roman emperors and looking like, you could, like, almost any of them could be a description of Trump. That, like, there's certain characteristics in, like, a terrible leader that repeat throughout history. And then also to understand that like we're dealing with a known entity and this is something that has happened before, been dealt with before, been toppled before or not, or it's gone horribly wrong and things are terrible for ages afterwards. But I think it's important to have that perspective and to understand that we can learn from those things and that we should be looking at them and seeing what went right and what went wrong with people's reaction to it. I mean, we're in a totally different age, but there are, you know, we're humans in history dealing with known quantities. And, like, what can we gain from that? Perspective, information, knowledge. And then also, like, there's a little bit of humor to it that, like,
right,
you know, you're seeing that you can read about Nero and, like, switch out the name and, like, you would have no idea that it's not Trump or Caligula or, you know, Tiberius. No, it's not. I'm going to forget.
How comforting is it to take in history, you know, that strongly and have that shed perspective on the contemporary?
I think for me, it's mm-hmm. comforting.
Mm-hmm.
Because knowledge is power, of course, and that it gives you a set of tools to react to something in a context that, at least for me, feeling like there's a context and a structure almost to, like, what's happening that's knowable,
mm-hmm.
Allows you to kind of react within a known quantity and system, and that is also, I mean, I like boundaries, I like structure, I guess, so mm-hmm. it just feels more purposeful. And I also think, like, going way back to what we were first talking about, is that my reaction to leaving the Mormon church was to find the comfort of fat in facts and in science against something that was so absurd to me. That, like, my go-to has always been, like, okay, well, let's find out some information and, like, see what's really going on here. Because there's things that you can know. And, like, that's where we should operate from. I know that that's not where everyone operates from, hence the current situation. But for me, facts, science, history, information are the things that are, kind of amazing and magical about the world. Like, you don't need religion. You have fucking nature and humans and stars and all of that stuff. So within that broader way of how I operate in the world and in my work, that has kind of just pivoted to how I'm reacting to trying to participate in stopping the terribleness that is happening.
Yeah. And I do want to come back to that, because there must be some little things that we haven't got to yet as far as what you've been doing. I mean, because I know we covered, you know, the protests, including the one at the airport.
Yeah.
And your calls, and you've also gone to some groups.
Oh my gosh, so many groups. I'm like,
do you want to list them all? Go
no,
ahead.
No, I'm trying to figure out. I can only go to so many, like.
It's like support groups that you're kind of checking out?
Yeah, I guess. Well, the first one I went to was great. They've all been great. I started going to one at Cloud and Man in Culver City that the artist Rebecca Farr started. And that was amazing. But it's so far away for me. And it's always on a weeknight. And, like, I don't drive. And so it's, like, expensive Ubers. But I still kind of want, like, it's like I haven't given up on anything. I feel like I need to find, like, a schedule again where I can be like, all right, I'll go there every 2 months, and then I'll do this one every week, and then I'll do.
Right, right.
But, and then I started going to one that was alternately closer in Silver Lake. Well, it was like there's an east side. 1 week it's east side. The next week it's west side, called Artivists Into Action.
Mm-hmm.
That was started by Yossi Sargent, who was instrumental in Obama's Hope campaign. He had, like, put out the call for, or orchestrated the call for artwork for posters, and, you know, of which the, or one of which was the Hope poster by Shepard Fairey that became so iconic. And then for a brief time, he also served as the head of the NEA, like the very beginning stages of Obama presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And now he runs a PR agency called Task Force that does, like, socially conscious PR and, you know, relates to art and things like that. So he had one, and that I've been to several times. It's kind of broader than just, like, the contemporary art world, which can be very helpful.
Yeah.
But one of the things I did with them was they did this parachute project where they fundraised and got all these parachutes that you paint on for marches. They're, like, great visuals for marches because you can take an aerial shot of them and it, like, makes a big impact. So I made a parachute for that and brought it to DC, and, like, you know, that was one of the things that the group that I was marching with, like, we carried the parachute, and that was amazing. And like, you know, people want to photograph it and people want to run under it. Like, it was a really nice visual, you know, with a message, and but then also, like, a thing that people were drawn to, like, engage with. So that was great.
To what extent are, from your experience, these artist-based political meetups about really starting to get something done at the meeting, you know, together, yeah, versus, like, letting off steam and then sort of brainstorming things you can do, and then most of that action actually happens when you leave?
Well, so then the next one that I went to, going through my list of, like, was the Artists Political Action Network that just started, like, 3 weeks ago, I guess, was the first big meeting. But then that broke off into smaller, really directed subcommittees. And that I joined the, like, tactical media subcommittee. So whereas the artist group is, like, they're bringing in speakers to tell you how to do things. They're, like, supporting projects that people bring up and want to do. APAN seems to be more, like, we went into groups. That group is super focused. Everyone has a really specific idea of where to go. And then that subgroup became smaller subgroups of, like, this is the action we're taking, you know. Here's what we're going to do.
And what were you doing?
So this is the tactical media. I mean, I just went to one of those meetings because that was the first one was on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of different ideas, but the project that I signed up to help with is like a billboard project that will kind of create the infrastructure and the information to do all kinds of billboards. But the first one, I feel like I don't want to give away the idea. Maybe I'll say it, but I can ask
no,
if
no,
I can
no, you
talk
could,
about it.
You can make it vague.
Okay. Was to kind of use like Bible messaging in conservative places to... It's like not even political. It's almost like I've had many conversations with friends who were brought up Christian or are Christian.
Yeah. By the way, I'm a little confused. So this is potentially such a great idea that maybe other people would take it up. And is that what you have some reservation
no,
about?
No, it's just because it wasn't my idea.
Oh, and you don't want to like claim it for your own.
I don't want to claim it for my own and or... Like, you know what I mean? I feel like I don't have ownership. Yeah, misrepresent it.
Right,
I don't have ownership
right.
of it. Like, I'm part of the team that's going to help do it.
Well, tell you what. If this person is listening,
yeah,
they can come in and they can take ownership
okay.
of it, right?
Well, I can say that it's Evan Holloway is the artist.
Oh, he'll never hear this.
He'll never hear
no,
it?
No. No. He will never hear this.
But what was I going to say? Oh, so it's the idea to, like, take... And I had kind of like I'd written Paul Ryan all these postcards with like Bible quotes of like, you know, the Bible says to like, you know, help the poor and like let when a stranger is in your land, you treat him as a citizen, essentially. Like, don't claim to be Christian and then support all this insanity, which is so un-Christian. Like,
which is unfortunately a Republican norm.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like the hypocrisy of that. I mean, yeah. And back to Mormonism, like the hypocrisy in Mormonism was one of the reasons why I was like, ugh. Can't.
She just made a tongue twister
yeah.
for people.
I
not
can't do
in
this.
The room.
And so the idea is to kind of like use like facts, like we going up there and putting a billboard in like a super red state that like states facts is not going to work. But if you use people's like parameters that they exist in already to maybe like shift how they think about something.
Yeah.
Like that could be a really powerful way to subtly shift something, you know, and it's subtle shifts.
Subtle
all
shifts
over.
Is like the sweet spot.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was one thing I was reading about, like, how do you change people's minds? Or like, how does policy change happen? Policy change starts with shifts in culture. Like small shifts in culture that then gain traction. Those people then put people into power that then enact policy that they support, which started with a culture shift. So what? Like,
mm-hmm.
Why am I going to, Will and Grace, great example.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right. Right.
All
yeah,
of
yeah.
a sudden, everyone or Ellen or what, you know, Will and Grace.
Does it make you
want to
get into TV?
No, but I know plenty of people who do that and I have no interest.
Right.
I think artists have a little niche in there that we can use our skills at like communicating visually to present information to people in a way that it's, you know, digestible for them to like have a shift, like have. And so
it's like I mean, this is one of the things I'm interested in on an ongoing basis is, and I'm organizing a show, by the way, that is sort of addressing it, which is didactic versus the ambiguous.
Okay.
And
yeah, very interesting.
There's something about hitting somebody over the head too hard and turning them off versus somehow, you know, slipping in.
Yeah.
This thing, which is a tricky thing because it's easy also to be then
too
soft.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like what's the sweet spot?
Right.
You know, but thinking like that, I think is really important. And I'm not sure that at least as an artist, that's not what's forefront in my mind. But as like an artist who has decided to do something active to change a situation outside of my art, that is the forefront of my mind.
Yeah.
So I think that is something also maybe artists are well poised to do is to find that middle ground because we are comfortable swimming in the waters of like, you know, the abstract and the unknown and the possible and not just the like hard edged.
Something that I was, and this was reminding me of something that I was talking about with Matt Gonzalez, who is the chief attorney of the public defender office in San Francisco and was a Green Party politician and who makes these collages, you know, that are formal, you know, and don't have really any political import.
Right.
So the question to you, I think, is since you mentioned the work that you're doing civically, you know, in addition to the work you're doing as an artist, does it make, how does it affect your art making? In other words, one sort of perception or one thing that one could anticipate is if you have this really strong outlet for your civic responsibility, does that then free you up to become more experimental and perhaps less sort of activist minded in your own work?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think that that is very true. I mean,
what is true?
That it has freed me up, that being so active.
But then you're making pictures of emperors.
I know, but then I felt comfortable to go back, I think, and be like, well, when I have to, like, I have some long goodbye paint that I was, for 2 years, I guess, I've been doing a series of The Birth and Death of Stars.
Right.
As a composition made up of subatomic decay patterns. So these kind of the two extremes of transformation, if you will, or birth and death, and that we're kind of in the middle of physically.
Speaking of perspective, right?
Yes. Well, and I think that so perspective has always been interesting to me, like in my work, whether it's like this series is like not political. It was like about sort of these, bigger, this is the biggest perspective that you could have,
right,
outside of like, you know, history and all of that.
Outside of the,
well, like human,
the
history.
Other universes. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, that's why I think afterwards it felt so like bad. Cause I was like, wait, it's too loose, you know, and this needs to be directed. And that, then the emperors and then, but two things I think happened when, I became so much more civically active daily, almost daily, is that it felt okay to go back and work on those again and enjoy it. And it also felt like an actual salve or like and relief in two ways. One, making them because it was, you know, outside of that kind of constant like strategizing and kind of anger and push in that direction. And that looking at the images that I'm referencing becomes like going in like a pool where I'm like, oh God, that's beautiful. Like, think like, wow, there's this, the importance that it's heightened why I was drawn to it in the first place, where that like dip into beauty has become like a necessary relief and like perspective and like graciousness to like the things that are not this terrible thing that's happening, you know?
And so you're making me think about, and again, this is goes back to the sort of one of those, it goes back, it doesn't go back. It relates to one of the things that I've been grappling with, which is, you know, that I've asked people on the show about, which is making abstract work, you
right.
know, or for, to put it more generally, work that is sort of about formal issues, that is about a certain form of beauty.
Right.
And what you, the sort of subtext of what you were just saying is, oh, so this is why all these people just focus on this really formal, beautiful stuff, because it's a salve from the world.
Yeah, maybe.
But that doesn't sound real good.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that that's what you're doing, but
I mean,
that's
fine that that's what you're doing.
No, but that's what you're inadvertently sort of referring to.
I mean, honestly, like I think that that is one function of art. Yeah. I mean, there's many functions of art.
It's the Matisse school of art, you know? Oh,
sure.
you need something that you can look at and relax in your armchair.
I mean, look, I'm not saying pretty. I think that's very different. I'm not saying make pretty pictures.
Explain
the difference between the beauty and pretty, the beautiful and pretty salve
that we're talking about in pretty, yes.
Because I think pretty does not... Beauty is sublime, and beauty has a darkness, an edge to it that is more complex than pretty. And that pretty, like, you can have something that is formal and like, I'm sorry, can I swear? We're gonna get, it's fucking beautiful. You can, but you can also have something that is just pretty, and right. pretty doesn't cross the line where you're going inside. Pretty doesn't sure. go beyond the eye. So
what, I know this week we could spend a whole episode talking yeah. about this, but just for a shorthand, if it happens to be easily within reach, how would you articulate to an artist who's mm-hmm. maybe listening some questions to ask for them to determine, how do I know if I'm not sure
yeah.
if I'm making work that might be darkly beautiful, as you're describing, right. versus just pretty?
Oh, God. That's or is like that, is the that, age-old question.
That's,
I mean,
just
I don't
objective.
Know.
It's subjective, well, isn't it?
That's, again, an amazing question. I don't know that I know how to answer that question.
Right.
I think it must be to some level a subjective, but I also do think that there is something objective to it, and I think that it probably goes down to something that's like the mathematics of emotion. I don't know if that's a
right.
thing, but
that's
that
a really,
there are
yeah.
like there are cues that turn your brain and your emotions in a way that are beyond formality. I mean, I think it like goes back to like patterning and like things being, I'm going to go in a kind of weird direction, but someone posted something after the Grammys about why like pop music is so shallow these days, like sounding and that it doesn't get to a place where things used to maybe go that were more off, and that like nobody uses the black keys on the piano anymore. Like there's no discord. So it kind of, I think it speaks to that same thing, that like something that's beautiful or truly moving to you has discord. Whatever that means and however that surfaces. Maybe it's a line right. that you don't expect to go in the direction, and it throws you and it pulls you back in a way that like makes you feel more instead of just like
I think those are excellent points, and I just want to, just for what it's worth, sort of put a since you know this is a kind of this is a very abstract conversation
yeah.
without two things to compare, but I think oftentimes it's a pretty fine line where something can be perceived as darkly beautiful
yeah.
and then just fall over. You
yeah,
know?
I agree. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that these are things that like are you know, go to the gut in some weird way. Like things, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
The humans have a way of like, experience, like, what am I? And I just lost that, my fly.
That little
it,
fly really likes you.
I was like,
by the
oh,
way, for those of you listening, Kaisa has been confronted by like a flea sized fly for the last like 10
to
minutes.
Catch it, which isn't very nice, I guess. Anyway, I forgot my point. Fly.
It'll come back.
The fly
to
didn't
you.
Like what we were talking about.
Right. It's a fly that's on the side of pretty.
Yeah, I mean, what? Like, okay, like one of my favorite movies of all time from when I was, like, whenever it came out, 10, Amadeus. Like, I think that's an amazing movie about that.
Right.
That's about that.
Right, the two characters yeah, represent
Salieri
those sides. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And Mozart. Like,
right.
That, these are
right.
the things. And, like, what did he have? Like, Salieri was amazing. He was great at what he did. But not that thing that made it go somewhere else. And, like, I don't know if I'm equipped to answer like what it is, and maybe you can't, because it's an elusive thing that like pulls all of these patterns together in a way that just shifts, you know, to unlock something.
Well, I wonder if part of it is the life that somebody lives, the
yeah.
lives that people live
sure.
in terms of how that object is going to take on that emotion that you're talking
right.
about.
Right. Right. As a viewer or as a creator or
as
both?
As a creator.
Yeah. No,
as
I think so. And I mean, not to be too like going from like, I rejected Mormonism for facts, and then like, well, is this elusive? What you put into something is what comes out of like hippie land. But I think there is something to that. And maybe
it doesn't
in a
sound
very
hippie.
Like direct way of like what, you know, literally physically and energy wise, like something is infused with a person who makes it.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Well, going back to you mentioned the Grammy, it has come up before, at least a couple times anyways. I've mentioned because it's come up somehow, pop music.
Yeah.
And yes, I mean, pop music for how the last, I don't know how many years, and your husband, I'm sure, could speak to this really well, but it's, you know, just get out of my ear. You know what I mean? Like, get away from
there's
me.
So many writers, and we talk about this all the time, too.
You and your husband.
My husband, he's in music publishing.
Mm-hmm.
That there's so many writers on a song. It can, like, kill it. And one of the songs that we both really liked, and it's an earworm, but I love it, is and it won a Grammy for, like, Best New Song or whatever. It's the, like, I don't know if I'm going to sing or not. Sometimes I have a good singing voice. Not always. It's the, like, If You Could Turn Back Time to the Good Old Days.
Who's it by?
I can't remember. It's two guys from, like, the Midwest. It's like, if I could turn back time to the good old days.
Are they a pop band more than a rock band? Or
they're like a... I guess they're a pop band, but I'm it's got sure like rap it. In it, you
oh,
know,
okay.
like, mm-hmm. Anyway, it's such a good song, and it's two friends who did it all, and like Lord is another artist who I think, you know, exists in the pop realm, and you can disagree with any of what I'm saying, but has seriously, don't disagree, you're so disagreeing with
you
me
know
right
what?
Now.
No, you know, I'm laughing because what? There is an awesome South Park episode
where
Lord turns out to be the creation of Stan's dad,
okay.
Randy, who's actually Lord.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that would be awesome. But it's not. And she knows she's like this teenager from New Zealand whose parents are poets. So, like, perfect. Like, of course, right?
Right.
And it's her and another writer, her and this guy, co-writer, do everything. Everything. Like, that's them.
Right.
And so, now we're getting way off. But, like, I just think there's... let's talk about pop music. I guess most pop is so constructed, is my point. And that you lose, going back, circling back to what we were talking about before, about something being, like, pretty or beautiful, that one of the ways to kill something is to have too many people putting something into it, because you lose what you were saying, which is the person's, you know, whole person and experience going into one thing or two people or whatever, like a unit.
You know what one of the great things about you is?
What? What?
She hasn't started turning red yet.
I know, totally. The fly
no.
is like me.
No, you know how to stay on topic.
Oh, you all right, do.
Thanks. You like bring it back.
Right.
And, okay, you know, good. It's like there's no sort of tangential. And I knew.
That's a good compliment.
I knew I would never have to worry for a second that you would ramble on about.
All right. Thank you. All right. So, good. Well, yeah, I like to stay. I don't want to go too
off
into left field. So, yeah. So circling back, I think it is. It does actually have relevance to what we were talking about before.
Yeah. We could, you know, dig further into pop and music and so on, but to that question that I had about pretty versus beautiful. But I think we should switch gears to, as we are an hour.
Yeah.
No, that's fine. not that I'm worried about time, but I think, so you feel like we covered, I mean, we could go on, but we generally covered your identity, your newer identity as a, you know, as a citizen activist in addition to your being an artist.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's an unlocked identity.
Right.
Like, I've always, you know, like, I remember being hysterically crying after seeing In the Name of the Father, which is, like, not even a great movie, you know? But, like, I've always been thinking of and conscious of these things, but maybe, like, not placed in a position of such opposition that it switched me. I mean, it's literally like a switch went on.
Well, speaking of crying, how long did you mourn after the election?
Oh, well, I couldn't get out of bed the next day, for sure. And, like, we were all crying. I mean, everyone that I was with had different reactions. But, like, a bunch of us were crying. I don't know. I pretty quickly flipped into the way that I deal with things is to try to. Apparently, this is like, I don't know what it is. I won't even go into that direction. But my reaction to things is to want to fix them. So I only feel comfortable if I'm doing something or
right.
moving or gathering information with which to do something. So for me, part of the like mourning process was to try to find any way that I could to do something and then to draw the emperors and reject for a minute my like, you know, whatever large scale perspective stuff to like smaller thousands of years scale versus like,
right.
you know,
right.
trillions of years.
Right. Scale. Right. Yeah.
So, or billions or,
I think that
I didn't mourn
okay.
that long. I mourned, but in a way that maybe right. wouldn't be considered mourning.
Yeah. 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 And I think that the action is really good and that helped. What would you say, this is what I want to ask you, what would you say to the sentiment that I'm sure you've experienced to some degree, that it's all so sort of depressing and overwhelming, you know, like
it
for
is.
People, right, for yeah. people who are emotional, I mean,
yeah.
I'm emotional
yeah.
when it comes to these things because it is so disheartening. I mean,
oh,
that
God.
That doesn't
yeah.
even begin to put a yeah. finger on it, but
yeah. we're but, collapsing.
But it's not necessary. I mean, maybe it has been for you, but it's not necessarily that cathartic to leave a voicemail, you know, with Dianne Feinstein. And, you know,
that's so, on your voicemail. I don't know.
Yeah, right, you, right.
Like,
right.
let loose.
Yeah.
No, I understand that. I think that's why I haven't just been calling, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think it's like a multifaceted.
That's why these meetings are the next phase. Yeah.
The meetings.
Right.
Absolutely. And
right.
feeling like, there's strategic ways. I get overwhelmed when I start thinking of all of the strategic ways. Like, oh, wait, do I need to focus on, like, flipping the county that's, like, two counties away to Democrat? Or do I need to focus on, you know, reaching into the heartland and, like, you know, presenting some truth in a way that is going to shift someone's, like, slightly? Or do I need to show up at every march? Or do I need to, you know, be hunting down ICE and stopping them from, you know, picking up people dropping off their kids from school, which is what's happening, and like throwing them in jail. Like, it's so huge, the level of awfulness that is happening at every scale. I mean, every meeting that I've been to, there's a common thread of what do you care most about? Because everyone's going to care about something different. And so pick that thing. Pick the thing and do the thing, because everyone's going to want to do something different. And
yeah.
if we're all doing one thing, that's enough to add up. And there was an article in The Guardian a few weeks ago that, like, studies have shown to successfully resist and topple a regime, which is what we are becoming, 3.5%, it takes 3.5% of the population to consistently engage. And I, from my bubble, so I don't know, but like, I feel like we have a larger
percentage.
It seems
like 3.5% is
low.
At least happening.
Yeah. Oh, at least.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I would go more for like 15% consistently.
Yeah.
Off of, based on nothing. Like, but.
Right.
So I'm almost more scared. So last night was the speech to Congress. That, you know, he read off a teleprompter. Yay, hooray, wow, good for him. He read a speech that someone else wrote, of course, that was not totally evil, you know, because our bar is so low that everyone's like, he did a great job, oh my god, like, he wasn't actively calling for the slaughter of babies or whatever, like,
right.
It's been so terrible that any softening of the terribleness, including, by the way, him being impeached and having Pence, who is terrible, but like not as overtly terrible because he knows how to, you know, be an adult, that will soften reaction, you know? I mean, coming from my own perspective, like, it wasn't enough for me in 2008 to get out and, you know, live at Occupy Wall Street, even though I felt angry and all of those, the system was bad and we needed to do something, that when it becomes less egregious, it's going to be harder to fight.
Yeah.
Yeah. But hopefully the switch that flipped on in me that has in so many other people hopefully is just on, you know, that it's brought on an awareness and an understanding of our government in a way that, like, I hadn't actively understood it before. Yeah. As someone who was interested in government and, like, had been always on, like, student government, like, I wasn't totally ignorant, but I'm so much more aware now of, like, the mechanisms in government, providing they stay around, you know?
yeah.
That's good. Like, so much people have become so educated in such a short amount of time that that doesn't go away. You don't unlearn things, you know? So in that way, like, that's a positive to the really negative. You know, I think the other positive, the double-edged sword is, social media and, like, the age of information, which has brought down in some weird way, brought down truth and facts because of the dissemination of the opposite of that. But also I think allowed for the resistance to that to amplify.
Right.
You know, so, like, that's good. You know,
in that group that you mentioned that you broke off into that has media in the title, right?
Yeah,
but that's not necessarily social media per se.
Well, I think it's also going to cover that in some way. So, you know, it's like thinking about how media is used to disseminate information, maybe shift people's perspectives that are open to perspective shifting and how that happens. Like looking at, you know, advertising and saying, like, how do people effectively manipulate people? I mean, this goes back to Nato Thompson's book, The
Seeing Power.
Seeing Power. And, well, I've started reading Culture as Weapon, which is his new one.
Wow. Good for you.
Which, well, when I was in
NATO,
New York,
where's my copy?
I know. Well, when I was in New York after the march, I stayed an extra day because there was this big storm, and he was giving a talk with Christian Viveros Funay, who's one of your guests.
And one of your former
gallerists. Yeah, and dear friend, one of my favorite people in the world. Shout out to Christian and Lisa and Pep. So he was in conversation with NATO, and I was excited because I'd heard your podcast and was like, so such a great conversation. Anyway, so then I got the book because I was at the reading, and, you know, he signed it or whatever, and I was like, I heard you on the Conversation podcast. It's so good. Anyway, so this book, and I'm only like an introduction and a chapter in, is so prescient about that like culture has been used as a weapon by the right, by advertising, by PR, by corporations, and, like, less so by the people who, like, purely produce culture. And that, I mean, that's kind of my understanding thus far. He can correct me if I'm wrong. And that these are things that we should actively be looking at and using, or at least understanding how they work and deciding to use them or not.
Yeah.
But it seems like this subcommittee that I'm in is kind of taking that mantle on of, like, how do we use our capacity as, like, culture makers and, like, turn it slightly in a way and strategize it to help our causes, you know?
I don't know if you're aware just sort of generally of the ads that ran during the Super Bowl, because a number of them were sort of, you know, multicultural friendly,
yeah,
if
sure.
you will. Do you feel like, based on what NATO's talking about, that's a step in the right direction, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, like, not, like, we shouldn't be... What's, like, one of the things he talks about in the introduction, and it speaks to another article that I was reading about, like, how to change people's minds, is that we're living in sort of the hopefully not the tail end of the, oh my God, why am I forgetting? I'm hitting the tired point.
I wanted
to say, like, Industrial Revolution, which is not what I wanted to say, even though that's where you are. Enlightenment. Sorry. We're kind of, you know, we're functioning still in this Enlightenment model of, how we think humans are, which is it's not a true perspective that we are not wired just to respond to reason and fact. Case in point where we are today, that there is a part of humans that is triggered by emotion. And to harness that is to be able to gain power. The right knows that, partially because people who are drawn to conservative ideals tend to have like brain structure they show that responds in that way. And a lot of this has to do with brain structure. There was a neuroscientist who wrote a whole article about like the left is not understanding how that we are confined by our brains and our brains can be ruled by emotion. Like that is, those are the power centers. Like your brain doesn't shoot off into fireworks when confronted with like a sweet fact, unless you're like, you know, a certain type of person. And that's not, you know, necessarily the majority of people.
Right.
So that we need to understand that, that those things are valuable, but kind of the entree into those things is like through the emotion centers. And to kind of give people facts, we kind of first have to get them like riled up and like feeling wound up with emotion.
Mm.
So that just we should be, you know, cognizant of that and not, and know what we're operating in and see how it's been used and maybe not be afraid of using it ourselves, you know? Even though it's like unreasonable,
I'm just right. I'm just imagining the terribleness
that can come out of that.
I was gonna say the challenge of getting NATO's book into the hands of appropriate
people
in politics.
Oh, sure. I mean, but I think that he's saying more, and again, he can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm only one chapter in, that it's like not necessarily like politicians, but like the citizens and the people or the culture makers, you know? Like,
yeah, he gives citizens a lot of credit,
a lot of power
and hope. Yeah, a lot of power. Maybe a little too much, but we'll see.
Maybe. I mean, but we're the boss. Like, I think we've forgotten that. Like, we're the boss of them, and we need to like
treat them like they're
not doing their working for us in the way they should.
Right. We're the boss of them, and they are also the boss of them. And unfortunately,
I know, right?
Yada, yada, yada. Anyway.
Like toddler. No. I'm the boss of me. Can't right. tell me what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
So, part two.
Okay.
Well, there you go. Part one. Thank you, Kaisa. There's more to come next week. I'll just give you a little preview. We get a little more personal, talk about her time in Scotland, where she was in school, and how much she loves it and misses it, and a number of other things more related to her art and so on. But it's a lot more personal side. It's not quite as long, but definitely, I think, worth coming back for. Thank you guys so much for being here. A few things before we go. I'm going to read you the latter part of that Catherine Schultz article that I was telling you about at the beginning. I think it'll give you a nice flavor of it and inspire you to probably read the whole thing. It basically covers the history of citizens being active in relation to their congresspeople and congresspeople in relation to their constituents and what kind of interaction is most effective ultimately. So it's very helpful in thinking about what kind of moves you make. But I just want to read the sort of closing summary angle, which I think will be a little bit inspiring, if not a lot. And before we get there, I wanted to make a request to you, and that is, I'm not going to ask you for more money, although certainly always welcome via PayPal or Patreon. But I found out recently from listening to a podcast about podcasts that a great way to grow a show is for the host to go on other podcasts. So I know most of you listen to a bunch of podcasts. If you listen to a podcast that you think I might be a good fit for as a guest, if you could recommend me to them, if they get maybe a couple of people recommending me to go on their show, maybe that will be enough to trigger some interest. So if you write a letter, an email to the host or producer of a podcast that you also enjoy and think is comparable in some ways, that would be great. I would really appreciate it. If you have any other ideas, places I can be promoted to, that would, you know, just reach out to me and I can do it myself. But would appreciate that very much in advance. And so let's get to that closing section of the Catherine Schultz article from March 6th called Call and Response, What Happens When You Phone Congress? And she's talked at this point about the resistance that both Democrats and Republicans are facing. And she writes, Republicans, of course, can't manage the resistance either. And so far, they are struggling to figure out how to respond. Some have merely expressed frustration that so many calls are apparently coming from out of their district or state. But others, including Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Cory Gardner, and President Trump, have tried to discredit concerned citizens by claiming that they are, quote, paid protesters, unquote, an allegation supported by precisely zero evidence. Still others have expressed disingenuous outrage over political organizing, as when Tim Murtaugh, a spokesperson for Representative Lou Barletta of Pennsylvania, criticized, quote, the significant percentage who were encouraged to call us by some group, unquote. And other legislators simply turned out not to like their job description. Quote, since Obamacare and these issues have come up, Representative Dave Brott of Virginia said last month, the women are in my grill no matter where I go, unquote. In an apparent effort to dodge such interactions, a number of Republican legislators, including Representative Mike Kaufman of Colorado and Representative Peter Roskam of Illinois, have canceled or curtailed town hall meetings. Other GOP legislators have allegedly been locking their office doors, turning off their phones, and, in general, doing what they can to limit contact with their constituents. That is not, of course, a viable long-term strategy. At a minimum, these lawmakers will need to begin showing their faces come re-election season. The deluge of constituent pressure, by contrast, is a viable long-term strategy, but only if it is a long-term strategy. That is, only if those doing it choose to sustain it. That would mean persevering in the face of both short-term defeats and the potentially energy-sapping influence of time itself. Think back to the conversation with Kaisa where she's talking about artists' perseverance versus constituent perseverance. Such perseverance is by no means impossible. Here, too, political causality is complex. Setbacks can as easily stoke as sap. Movements may grow as well as wither, and every critical mass has, of necessity, been built from a subcritical one. Moreover, and luckily for democracy, none of us requires a guaranteed outcome in order to act. We all do plenty of things without knowing if or when or how much they will work. We say prayers, take multivitamins, give money to someone on Second Avenue who looks like she needs it. So too with calling and emailing and writing and showing up in congressional offices. It would be good to know that these actions will succeed, but it suffices to know that they could. And at this particular moment, when our First Amendment freedoms are existentially threatened, when the president himself has, among other things, sought to curb press access and to discredit dissent, we also act on them to insist that we can. The telephone might not be a superior medium for participatory democracy, but it is an excellent metaphor for it, and it reminds us of the rights we are promised as citizens. When we get disconnected, we can try to get through. When we get no answer, we can keep trying. When we have to, for as long as we need to, we can hold the line. That is some beautiful writing. Would you not agree? Wow. I almost got a little emotional reading that. Did you hear that? So thank you guys so much for being here. Before we go, I wanted to give a big shout out. I really, really love getting big support from new listeners or listeners who I had otherwise been aware of. And Jay Bell, who is an artist in Los Angeles and is also an executive at a company called Telacu, T-E-L-A-C-U, which is a community development corporation that is very geared towards revitalizing communities and working in empowerment for communities and that kind of thing as part of their business model. So it sounds like a pretty solid organization. He gave a $100 donation. So thank you. Big thank you to you, Jay, and Jay Bell. Appreciate it. And if you guys are so motivated to support the show, this is an ongoing fundraising routine. So thank you for bearing with that part of the show. Thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate it. I will talk to you, and Kaisa will talk with me next week. In the meantime, be well, be active, and ciao for now.